Thank you all for coming. My name is Greg Lanave. I'm a professor of theology here at the Pontifical Faculty. It is my pleasure to introduce our next speaker, Father Gabriel O'Donnell. Father O'Donnell entered the Order of Preachers in 1963 and was ordained a priest in 1970. He holds advanced degrees in liturgical studies and spiritual theology, including an MA from the University of Notre Dame, a licentiate in sacred theology from the Angelicum, and a doctorate in sacred theology from the Trezianum in Rome. He has served on the faculty of several institutions, including St. John's Seminary in Philadelphia, the Angelicum, and two stints here on the Pontifical Faculty. I first met Father O'Donnell when he was appointed dean of our faculty, a position he filled most admirably from 2007 to 2013. All of us who were on the faculty at that time can attest to the energy and confidence with which he took on a task that none of us, including him, ever would have chosen to do, namely the reaccreditation of our school. We enjoy the fruits of his efforts today, and we are all profoundly grateful for them. The demands of the office of dean left him little time to teach, but that has happily changed, and we are happy to have his services now as ordinary professor of spiritual theology. In addition to his academic work, Father O'Donnell presently serves as the postulator for the cause for sainthood of Father Michael J. McGivney, the founder of the Knights of Columbus, and Father Paul of Greymore, the founder of the Franciscan Friars of the Atonement. With Robin Moss, Father O'Donnell is the author of Spiritual Traditions for the Contemporary Church, published by Abingdon Press in 1990, and he contributed, along with his confreres Joseph Augustine de Noia, Romano Cesario, and Peter John Cameron, to A Love That Never Ends, A Key to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, published by our Sunday Visitor in 1996. The title of his talk today is Reform, Promotion, and Participation in the Church of Christ, Sacrosanctum Concilium in the 21st Century. Please join me in welcoming Father Gabriel O'Donnell.
Thank you. Before I begin, I should warn you a little. It's a little warning because my presentation is actually quite simple. It has a very straightforward theme, and it is that the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, Sacrosanctum Concilium, in launching an unprecedented full-scale revision of the liturgy of the Roman Church, called for theological, historical, and pastoral preparation for this enormous undertaking. The Constitution intended that both instruction and formation be carried out by the hierarchy, by priests, by pastoral workers, which it presumed would require that they first of all would be provided themselves with this formation. Compliance with this requirement of the Constitution or failure to honor it accounts in large measure, I think, for the dynamics of the liturgical reform in the church in the United States, and that's really what I want to talk about. The issue of the reason I'm hesitant about the topic is because, of course, I lived through this, and most of you have only heard about it as a vague rumor. And so there has to be some rehearsal of history, and that can be annoying, so I ask you to bear with me. Every student in Liturgy 101 learns early on the distinction between chronos and kairos in the study of the liturgical year. Chronos indicates the measurement of time one moment following another, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day. Calendar and clock allow us to measure the passage of chronological time. Kairos, in contrast, indicates the measurement of time by significance and meaning. Births, deaths, anniversaries, feasts, they mark important moments in life. Celebratory rituals measure kairotic time and become the expression of corporate memory. This distinction between chronos and kairos, as applied to time, might be a useful entry into our topic, the 21st century reception of Sacrosanctum Concilium, the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, the first document issued by the Council. We find there well-mined themes of ecclesiology, ressourcement, and aggiornamento within a context of expectation and, one might say, optimism about modernity and the cultural revolution occurring simultaneously with the sessions of the Council. A distinction similar to that between chronos and kairos might be made to assist in our assessment of the situation within the Catholic Church in the United States during the second half of the 20th century. Well before an ecumenical council was considered a possibility, cultural forces of the 19th and early 20th centuries were impinging on the world of North American Catholicism. Secularization in all its forms was taking a toll on ordinary Catholic daily life. For example, the definitive turn to the subject with self-actualization as life's central project. The movement to greater personal autonomy and egalitarianism. Women's rights and the feminist movement. And finally, special interest groups as they came to dominate the social horizon. The then new attention to minority rights, persons with disabilities, the gay lobby, and of course, the sexual revolution posed serious threats to the family and other foundational social institutions. Scientific exploration and technological advances often muted the voices of religious and political leaders. The placing of the first man on the moon became a 20th century icon for future possibilities. These cultural forces pulled at the minds and imagination of everyone, even devout Catholics, and this was the cultural context in which the announcement of the Second Vatican Council and its eventual achievements were received in North America. The culture proposed and sometimes promised a future in which human potential would be realized within our chronological experience. This achievement would be its own reward. Clearly, Chronos at work. In contrast, the Catholic culture among the faithful in North America, then still relatively strong, clung to the supernatural understanding of faith as determining a future not coterminous with death, but a future into eternity. Sin, death, judgment, heaven and hell were regular topics for Sunday sermons, retreat conferences, and religious instruction. The far-reaching parochial school system and the release time instruction for Catholics in public schools provided a unique vehicle for fostering religious and spiritual convictions that were beginning to be in tension with the cultural revolution swirling around the Catholic community. The Baltimore Catechism, the standard formation tool for American Catholics, asked, "Why did God make me? God made me to know him, to love him, and to serve him in this life, and to be happy with him in the next." The existence of heaven and hell and the possibility of personal damnation kept the Saturday confessional lines filled. Sacrosanctum Concilium and the liturgical reform. When Sacrosanctum Concilium appeared in 1964, many Catholics read it as a call to conform to modernity, and to carry out the aggiornamento expressed in the document as a call for the church to adapt to a broader cultural agenda already referred to. Reluctant parishioners went along with the liturgical changes proposed by the Concilium, often misunderstanding this as a necessary capitulation on the part of the church to the secular world and its values. The faithful were ill-prepared to distinguish between conciliar aggiornamento and the cultural revolution simultaneously sweeping the continent. Bishops, priests, and religious brothers and sisters who had already become familiar with the cultural shifts even prior to the council were either unprepared or unable to frame the reform of the liturgy as a countercultural movement, but often read the movement as part of the Catholic absorption into modern culture and society. Certainly, John the 23rd and the Council Fathers were concerned with the future, but their vision was primarily theological, we might say more kairotic. For it was aimed at acknowledging the work of Christ in saving the world from sin and death, so that we might have a future of eternal beatitude, that we might participate in the very life of the triune God. Theirs was not a promise concerning the chronological focus of the culture, but the kairotic vision of the gospel and the paschal mystery of Jesus Christ. As Aidan Nichols has pointed out in several places, Sacrosanctum Concilium is to be noted for its eschatological vision. In that sense, the Constitution, so largely touted as pastoral, is also a theological document. However, for many Catholics in the United States, the distinction between chronos and kairos, between culture and faith, went unobserved and unacknowledged. Consequently, the message of the council and its teaching was received in a confusion between cultural forces, which constituted the real world, the world of the here and now, and the vision of faith, constituting the unreal world of religious conviction and sentiment, a life of future spiritual fulfillment. A glance at recent church demographics suggests that this confusion has continued to plague the church in the United States well into the 21st century. The reform of the liturgy, as other issues in the contemporary church, will not likely mature and bear the fruit desired by the fathers of Vatican II until this confusion is addressed and resolved through recourse to a theology of the liturgy based on sound principles and the provision for liturgical instruction and formation, which Sacrosanctum Concilium itself declared as the necessary preparation for a full, active, and conscious participation in the actual celebration of the sacred liturgy. Read from a 21st century perspective, it is not difficult to trace the post-Vatican II reactions to the liturgical reform in the United States. The intentions of the Council Fathers, laid out in the introductory first number of the Constitution, were read by United States Catholics with what might be described as a cultural and religious and naivete. I quote, "This sacred council has several aims in view. It desires to impart an ever-increasing vigor to the Christian life of the faithful, to adapt more suitably to the needs of our own times those institutions which are subject to change, to foster whatever can promote union among all who believe in Christ, to strengthen whatever can help to call the whole of mankind into the household of the church. The council, therefore, sees particularly cogent reasons for undertaking the reform and promotion of the liturgy, close quote. Note the language. Adapt, reform, promotion, as well as to foster, to strengthen. In other places, the Constitution will speak of restoration. For the American church, the themes of reform and participation almost at once became the focus of academic and pastoral instruction and discussion. Whatever the intention of the council, the text of Sacrosanctum Concilium seemed sufficiently ambiguous to make room for a possible American misunderstanding. Number 15 of the Constitution seemed to provide the warrant. I quote, "Mother Church earnestly desires that all the faithful should be led to that fully conscious and active participation in liturgical celebrations, which is demanded by the very nature of the liturgy. Such participation by the Christian people as a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a redeemed people, is their right and duty by reason of their baptism. In the restoration and promotion of the sacred liturgy, this full and active participation by all the people is the aim to be considered before all else, for it is the primary and indispensable source from which the faithful are to derive the true Christian spirit, and therefore pastors of souls must zealously strive to achieve it by means of the necessary instruction in all their pastoral work." Close quote. Given this clear mandate, the shift to a more community-oriented celebration and the gradual muting of the vertical dimension of divine worship seemed justified to many in the decades immediately after the council. The impulse to transform the liturgy into something closer to real life and to delete otherworldly elements became a goal for not a few American liturgical leaders. I was for 10 years the member of a commission translating the Latin proper texts of the Dominican Order into English. It was a committee of about 12, sometimes 15 people made up of friars from different provinces and religious women. When we were dealing with the propers for the Feast of Corpus Christi, one of the members of the committee, a religious sister who had just finished her doctorate at CUA in liturgy, writing under Mary Collins for her dissertation, said, "I think we should get rid of all this language about, you know, bread from heaven and the food of angels." And, you know, of course, it was like using a taser gun. You know, I was like, "Gah!" And I said, "But this is the language that our Lord uses in the gospel. I mean, I wish you would stop saying our Lord. We don't say that anymore. You should say Jesus. Why do you keep saying our Lord?" And I said, "Because Jesus told me to." She didn't like me much after that. But in those years, the membership on that committee, I would say there was a tremendous amount of this, really a kind of ignorant wanting to delete things that were warranted in Scripture and in the tradition of the ancient tradition of the church, both in the writings of the fathers and in the liturgy itself. Participation, that aim to be considered before all else as a primary and indispensable source of the Christian spirit, came to mean literal participation in the words and actions of the Mass. The congregation was encouraged to join the priest in speaking, singing, and gesturing during various parts of the Eucharist. Failure to promote this mode of participation was considered retrograde and unfaithful to the spirit of the council. Even if a fuller, more theological understanding indicated that certain texts belonged exclusively to the priest, for example, the doxology at the end of the Eucharistic prayer, the congregation was invited to join in saying the text and mimicking the celebrant's gestures as a more active form of participation. A very narrow definition of participation was emerging, and little attention was paid to other less crassly physical modes of participation. To the further detriment of the situation, the final paragraph of number 15 of the Constitution was often overlooked. I quote, "Yet it would be futile to entertain any hopes of realizing this participation unless the pastors themselves, in the first place, become thoroughly imbued with the spirit and power of the liturgy and undertake to give instruction about it. A prime need, therefore, is that attention be directed, first of all, to the liturgical instruction of the clergy." The text calls for a prior renewed theology and spirituality of the liturgy if authentic liturgical reform, renewal, adaptation, restoration is to be achieved. This mandate for theological liturgical instruction and spiritual formation, first of all for the clergy and then for the body of the faithful, went largely unheeded in both the academy and among Catholic pastoral workers in the United States. Number 23 of the Constitution summarized what is required if the reform intended by the Council was to be successful. I quote, "In order that sound tradition be retained, and yet the way remain open to legitimate progress, a careful investigation, theological, historical, and pastoral, should always be made into each part of the liturgy which is to be revised. Furthermore, the general laws governing the structure and meaning of the liturgy must be studied in conjunction with the experience derived from recent liturgical reforms and from the indults granted to various places. Finally, there must be no innovations unless the good of the church genuinely and certainly requires them, and care must be taken that any new forms adopted should in some way grow organically from forms already existing." Close quote. In contrast to this organic methodology, much of what passed for liturgical instruction in the post-conciliar period centered on liturgical praxis. Innovation, so carefully dealt with in number 23 of the Constitution, became a standard topic for diocesan and parochial liturgy committees. What can we do to make Advent more meaningful? As the culture became progressively imbued with notions of autonomy and egalitarianism, accountability to the hierarchy in matters liturgical became resented and, in time, resisted. In the extreme, some even professed a faithful dissent from the authority of the church if norms and correctives did not correspond with the lived experience of the celebrating person or community. Having witnessed the confusion of the 20th century, a 21st century reading of Sacrosanctum Concilium is less inclined towards a literal and a horizontal reception and far less tolerant of innovation. For a whole segment of those engaged in liturgical education and liturgical reform, it seemed that only a radical overhaul of the Roman Rite, often involving real discontinuity with the past, could be the way forward, legitimized, it seemed, by number 21 of the same Constitution. I quote, "In order that the Christian people may more certainly derive an abundance of graces from the sacred liturgy, Holy Mother Church desires to undertake with great care a general restoration of the liturgy itself. For the liturgy is made up of immutable elements divinely instituted and of elements subject to change. These not only may but ought to be changed with the passage of time if they have suffered from the intrusion of anything out of harmony with the inner nature of the liturgy or have become unsuited for it. In this restoration, both texts and rites should be drawn up so that they express more clearly the holy things which they signify. The Christian people, so far as possible, should be enabled to understand them with ease and take part in them fully, actively, and as befits a community. Close quote. Sacrosanctum Concilium speaks of restoration, but it also provides a template for those, quote, elements subject to change, close quote, which not only may but ought to be changed. For the liturgical establishment in the United States, it seemed that reform was to be preferred to restoration. The immutable was less important than those elements that could be redesigned or arranged in some new way. The attempt to express more clearly the holy things which they signify was taken to mean the elimination of hieratic language and the removal of literary images and phrases that did not easily or immediately speak to men and women of our day. The impact of these attitudes at the level of the parish and other pastoral situations was felt rather immediately in the two decades after the council. No alternative viewpoint or competing ideas to this confused notion of reform and restoration were widely voiced until the appearance in the 21st century of Liturgiam Authenticam and the publication of the third edition of the Roman Missal early in our century. Promotion and participation in the mind of the Council Fathers and in the text of Sacrosanctum Concilium implies education, instruction, formation. Clearly, the response of the American hierarchy, clergy, religious, and directors of religious education to this plainly stated intention of the Constitution was less than wholehearted. Sacrosanctum Concilium in the Church of the United States. Any overview of an historical moment, of course, is not it is not useful to blame individuals or institutions, given the complexity of life as it unfolds. Nonetheless, an honest assessment of the post-Vatican II liturgical revolution in the United States suggests that the hierarchy, clergy, religious educators, and formators of the same period were ill-prepared to lead the faithful into the liturgical reform and renewal promulgated by the Council. The explanation, in part, being the same confusion between culture and religious faith that assailed the body of believers who were in the pastoral care of these leaders. Likewise, the preference to take on the reform, promotion, and renewal of the liturgy as tasks to be accomplished rather than to engage in a program of rigorous study and reflection on the theological roots of the liturgy kept the American church in a decidedly parochial mindset in its reception of Sacrosanctum Concilium. The very decade in which Sacrosanctum Concilium was promulgated marked the initial decline in the Catholic educational system, the decrease in vocations to the priesthood and religious life, and through the programs of many Catholic colleges and universities, the dissemination of a view of the Catholic faith that, while politically correct, was not always faithful to the doctrinal foundations of our faith. Certificates and Master of Arts degrees in religious education, catechetics, liturgical studies, pastoral theology, and liturgical music became instruments in shaping a generation of teachers and pastoral workers who were either unable to withstand the pressures of cultural changes or welcomed them as a kind of manifest destiny for a new and radically changed church in the United States. They failed to calculate how quickly secularization, chronos, would overwhelm the sacred, kairos. The theological gave way to the historical, the anthropological, the practical, and ultimately to the secularizing influences of the culture. New programs to prepare liturgical experts abounded in this period. Graduates of these programs often viewed liturgical formalities as archaisms and theological and canonical principles as requiring revision and updating in light of historical and anthropological considerations. The often repeated mantra, "Law follows life," revealed the confidence with which priests, liturgists, religious educators, and catechists considered themselves free to fashion worship services according to their particular understanding of church, ministry, ritual, and sacrament, some even suggesting possible changes to the matter and form of the Eucharist itself. In the 1960s, there was the Coke and pizza suggestion. It's horrifying to us today, but it was actually talked about. The project of liturgical experimentation was led by credentialed practitioners at the grassroots of Catholic educational and parochial life. Systematic theology was not strongly represented in most degree and certificate programs. The works of theologians such as Hans Küng, Karl Rahner, and Edward Schillebeek were presumed to provide any needed theoretical underpinnings for the liturgical reform which fueled the wide interest in liturgical studies. The first day of class when I went to Notre Dame many years ago, it was in the 1960s, of course, the first day of class in the liturgical education program was Hans Küng's the Church. Read this, and you'll have no problems from here on in. Well, of course, coming from here, as a theology student preparing for the priesthood, I had lots of problems, but I survived. The notable absence of instruction in areas of Christology and sacramental theology were indications of the direction and quality of future religious and catechetical formation. While medieval liturgical practice was considered interesting, the theological synthesis coming from that period was decreed irrelevant. Critics of the liturgical reform of Vatican II. While many parishes, universities, chaplaincies, and houses of formation for religious embraced the principle of discontinuity in the liturgy and followed the path of desacralization in worship, there were nonetheless critics of the liturgical reform in the United States. Some challenged any change to what they considered the timeless and immutable character of the holy sacrifice of the Mass as found in the Missal of Pius V. Others, accepting the legitimacy of the Novus Ordo, evaluated the new Mass from a variety of perspectives. The failure to distinguish the Council's call for aggiornamento and ressourcement from the cultural movement towards secularization and desacralization fed confusion and disillusionment among faithful and clergy alike. Updating liturgical forms was often seen as discontinuity with the past and the rejection of issues broader than the liturgy. In time, the identity of the priest, the role of the lay faithful in ecclesial ministry, the validity of a religious life based on a vow of obedience, the governance of the church, and even the meaning of the Eucharist itself became part of the agenda that was ascribed to the spirit of Vatican II. A wide trajectory of questioning and refashioning traditional practices and institutions became part of the daily fare of Catholic life. While it is true that many of the criticisms that have been outlined in various academic works stirred up lively debate in the lecture halls, one really must question the effect of the critics in slowing the process of liturgical updating that dominated pastoral situations, which had become the domain of newly minted liturgists and pastoral theologians. The elimination of parish novenas and benediction of the Blessed Sacrament, the cutback or cancellation of weekly confession times, and the widespread renovation of churches and chapels now denuded of statues, communion rails, and ornate sanctuary decorations were carried out at a furious pace in the 1960s and 1970s. The stark and the simple was the order of the day. Replacing imposing crucifixes with images of the risen and glorious Christ was, in some places, the litmus test of just how liturgically progressive a community could be judged. Critics found the tendency to reduce liturgical language and symbols to the lowest common denominator in order to be easily understood by the congregation, a betrayal of the very nature of the mysteries being celebrated. The loss of a sense of the transcendent, as liturgical actions and symbols were made more transparent and therefore more real, had deleterious effects on the liturgy in the estimation of the critics. As Don Saliers, the Protestant liturgical scholar, writes, we never have access to the unmediated, pure meaning of symbols. The water, the bread and wine, the cross, the word, always reveal and conceal. Again, as another author puts it, this mysterious hiddenness within worship needs to be protected. Any attempt to articulate precisely the exact nature of symbol is doomed to failure, since its power and efficacy rests on its polyvalence and sense of remoteness. Academics, whether in the area of theology, philosophy, or anthropology, who engaged in criticizing the liturgical reform were less vocal about ritual forms and generally more concerned with the texts found in the new ritual books. Historians had, of course, of necessity, to compare, contrast, and evaluate changes in the format of sacramental and liturgical rites. But even they were more concerned about the social, about the historical and sociological implications of textual changes. The pontificate of St. John Paul II. From the earliest days of his pontificate, the enormous intellectual energy and theological creativity of St. John Paul were apparent. Having lived under the threat of communism and served the Catholic people of Poland as they sought to throw off the ideology that attempted to subjugate the church to the power and direction of the state, J.P. II had long experience and had pondered the dangers of alien cultural forces pressing upon the faith of the Catholic people. His attempts to create a culture of love and a culture of life that would overcome the culture of death and godlessness evidenced his awareness of what was at stake in any capitulation to forces hostile to the faith and to the church. For him, continuity with the past and with tradition was not a question of conservative versus liberal. His apostolic vision required the proclamation of the faith in all its fullness, convinced as he was that only in that fullness could the church move boldly into the future. With Vatican II as his point of reference, John Paul II attempted to bring the spirit of the Council into the 21st century by providing a contemporary theological understanding of the human person with a strong conviction regarding the universal call to holiness to be consummated in a life of Trinitarian communion. Well-versed in philosophy and theology, the body of his work constitutes a comprehensive catechesis of the Christian life for the 20th and 21st centuries, precisely the quality of instruction and formation envisioned by Sacrosanctum Concilium. As early as 1988, on the 25th anniversary of the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, Pope John Paul II expressed his conviction that the work of liturgical form was not yet complete. The time has come to renew, I quote here, the time has come to renew that spirit which inspired the Church at the moment when the Constitution Sacrosanctum Concilium was prepared, discussed, voted upon, and promulgated, and when the first steps were taken to apply it. In the work of liturgical renewal desired by the Council, it is necessary to keep in mind, with great balance, the part of God and the part of man, the hierarchy and the faithful, tradition and progress, the law and adaptation, the individual and the community, silence and choral praise. Thus, the liturgy on earth will fuse with that of heaven, where it will form one choir to praise with one voice the Father through Jesus Christ. Vicesimus Quintus Annus of 1988. While at the pastoral level there was little change in the celebration of the liturgy throughout the United States during the pontificate of JP II, the concerns for greater balance referenced in the text we have just heard was reiterated by the already by the critics of the reform. During the pontificate of John Paul II, particularly the decade prior to the millennium, there was a sharpening of opposing views in matters related to the liturgical reform. The phrase, the reform of the reform, signaled that critics of the liturgy, now more articulate and organized, were lobbying for some practical action. Some suggested this to be the ideal moment to unravel the theological and cultural morass that was thought to dominate the liturgical reform. The 1997 rejection of the ISIL Psalter by the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments became symbolic for those dissatisfied with the liturgical status quo. That really was a watershed moment, the decision of the congregation to reject the proposed ISIL Psalter. Some thought the liturgical tide to be turning in a more traditional or conservative direction with the appearance of Liturgiam Authenticam, the 2001 replacement for Comme le prévoit as the guide for translating liturgical texts into the vernacular. With Liturgiam Authenticam in place, the 2002 appearance of the Editio Typica of the third edition of the Roman Missal was seen by some to be a vindication of criticisms expressed beginning with the first appearance of the Missal in 1969. Certainly, it seemed that one could be optimistic that an improved translation was on the horizon. From the vantage point of the second decade of the 21st century, one can see in the publication of Liturgiam Authenticam an attempt to address the issue far deeper than the quality of vernacular translations. The desire to provide a vehicle whereby the integrity of the faith is preserved in liturgical forms. In the event, the battle over the new translations was not easily resolved. The dynamic equivalency theory of Comme le prévoit, liberally employed by ISIL, the sole provider for English translations, was challenged by Liturgiam Authenticam's requirement that translations should be characterized by more literal closeness to the Latin and reflect its simplicity and beauty, all the while preserving the theological integrity of the particular collect or text. In the ISIL translations, in the long run, widely considered inadequate, the triumph of Chronos over Kairos was particularly obvious. Not only did cultural concerns figure largely in ISIL's translation policies, but serious theological accommodations were made in the interest of producing texts that would be culturally acceptable to the faithful of the late 20th century. There were those of an opposing view. Quote, Liturgiam Authenticam is deliberately intended to replace Comme le prévoit as the standard for translation. It called for it called for thorough scrutiny in the context of this work, since in many ways it shows that the critics of the Reform have now become the proprietors of the Church's liturgy. Rather than grappling with the heart of the problem, the nature of the liturgy itself, the publication of Liturgiam Authenticam was seen as one more move in a struggle for power and control. The struggle was not yet over. The critics of the liturgical reform were now to endure counter-criticism from those who continued to pursue the translation policies and liturgical trends which were put in place immediately after the Council in the United States. Number 31 of Liturgiam Authenticam provided specific guidelines for what we have come to refer to as inclusive language. Some liturgical experts ascribed ulterior motives to Liturgiam Authenticam. I quote, "This directive does read like a torturous attempt to avoid inclusive language, and one has to wonder whether the desire to avoid inclusive language has more to do with the fear of recognizing women as the camel's nose under the tent with regard to women's ordination, rather than with a desire to be more accurate or faithful in translating texts." That gives you a sense of the feel of what was going on. It wasn't pretty. In referencing Liturgiam Authenticam's call for language that is more reverent and sacral, Bishop Donald Troutman adjudicated the argument between advocates of Comme le Prévoit, the work of Eisel, and the proponents of Liturgiam Authenticam in this way. An unfortunate example is the insistence on using chalice instead of cup for kalichem in the translation of the Eucharistic institution narrative. Surely the 4th century framers of the Roman canon intended calyx to mean cup rather than chalice in that particular context. Will the liturgy really become more reverential because of the use of pointless archaisms? Close quote. Such comments may lack depth, but they convey well the mood of tension and struggle during those years. The divergence of opinion over liturgical texts and their translation was emblematic of parallel struggles in the areas of liturgical music, ritual action, liturgical art, and architecture that continue even into our own time. One of the puzzling questions raised by the state of the liturgical reform during the final decades of the 20th century is why, given the clarity of thought and its expression in both the spoken and written word of Pope John Paul II, did the confusion between culture and faith continue among U.S. Catholics? While unsatisfying to answer a question with yet another question, there is a prior consideration before us. That is the quality and extent of the participation of the American Catholic Church in the papacy of John Paul II. There is really little evidence of multiple programmatic attempts to convey the teaching of John Paul II to clergy and faithful, whether at the diocesan or parochial level, or in any way, in any systematic way, to collectively move in the direction the pontiff carved out for the Church of the 21st century. The call to the new evangelization expressed JP2's conviction that a renewal of the Church was within our grasp if Catholics would open their minds and hearts to the full message of the gospel instead of preaching and teaching selectively a version of Catholicism that might be more manageable. The failure of the American Catholic Church to comprehend the enormity of the project Pope John Paul envisioned is evidenced by the lack of attention to his teaching and vision at the level of the Conference of Bishops, to the small parishes in rural areas. Of necessity, the clergy abuse scandal preoccupied members of the hierarchy. Nonetheless, there is little evidence of serious efforts to create a moment, a Catholic moment of renewal across the nation, parish to parish, diocese to diocese. Rather, many of the problems and issues of the time were dealt with in ways that suggested pragmatic and practical solutions being preferred to using theological and spiritual principles to determine the direction to be taken. The pressures of the secular world could crowd out a uniquely Catholic approach to problems and situations. In light of his pastoral leadership extending from 1978 to 2005, the American church may have failed to understand the ecclesial vision of John Paul II and its potential for the formation of Catholics, clergy, and lay faithful alike. I'm going to skip ahead because I know we want to finish on time. Though I didn't start really on the half hour, did I? Mezza. He's saying, yeah, skip ahead. Okay, got it. Pope Benedict and the liturgical reform. This is somewhat the situation when, in 2005, as Ratzinger became Benedict XVI, with his already published views on many liturgical matters. With his papacy, the 21st century was launched in a decidedly new direction in terms of liturgical style and policy. In the 2007 issuance of the Motu Proprio Summorum Pontificum, with its widening provision for the celebration of what was to be called the extraordinary form, Benedict brought his acknowledged attachment to the Missal of Pius V into the magisterium of the Church. Further, the precedent was set for a plurality of liturgical rites in the future. Benedict's liturgical leadership could be described as strongly chirotic, and some have even at times described it as mystical. He was concerned with the recovery of the sacred, the cosmic, and even the eschatological aspects of Christian worship, and this not simply from the storehouse of his own reflection and experience, but from his engagement in genuine scientific exploration of the sources of the Roman Rite. In his thoughts, there was no confusion with cultural movements. Reverence and the careful observance of liturgical norms were coupled with Benedict's understanding that in the celebration of the sacred mysteries, heaven and earth meet, and the whole of the created world is embraced by the court of heaven. The liturgy is sacred because it is not made by human hands. It is the work of God. It is God coming to meet man in order to acquaint him with his future life in eternity. Benedict encouraged a more elaborate decoration of the altar and what some describe as a more contemplative mood in the celebration of the sacred mysteries. To some, this suggested a consolidation of the liturgical dispositions contained in Liturgiam Authenticam and the publication of the vernacular versions of the third edition of the Roman Missal. The startling 2013 announcement of his resignation from the papacy suggested early in the second decade of the second century yet another new direction might obtain in the ongoing reform of the liturgy. I'm going to skip to the end here, the future of liturgical reform. Number 7 of Liturgiam Authenticam contains an interesting phrase not often noted in our day. Quote, "This instruction envisions and seeks to prepare for a new era of liturgical renewal, which is consonant with the qualities and the traditions of the particular churches, but which safeguards also the faith and the unity of the whole Church of God." Close quote. So it is time to attend to this new era with a clear understanding of the current situation of the church in the United States. I would like to cite several factors that, in my estimation, are significant in shaping the situation of the church in the United States at present. First, the chief instrument for the religious, sacramental, and liturgical formation of Catholic children and young adults in the United States was for more than half of the 20th century the parochial school system. Since this is generally not the case today, the hierarchy and clergy have yet to successfully find an alternative for the formation of young Catholics in the faith. With at least two generations of largely uncatechized Catholics in our country, the issue of religious formation is critical and will impinge greatly on the future of the ongoing liturgical renewal. Second, the confusion between culture and faith continues to create difficulties among Catholics in our country. The cultural movement towards moral relativism and inclusivity, often promoted by special interest groups, has had disastrous effects on Roman Catholicism in our time. Social scientists have been tracking this shift in values and attitudes, particularly among emerging young adult Catholics, and the implications are somewhat ominous. This has brought into the heart of Catholic life the polarization and politicization which ails our country at large. Third, the fallout from the shift in liturgical emphasis and style which has taken place in the last couple of decades among priests ordained during that period has been significant for the church in the United States. Many bishops and pastors have been compelled to deal with the new liturgical style adopted by these younger men. At the turn of the century, a generation of JP2 priests had already entered the ministry with an enthusiasm for a traditional style of liturgical celebration. Influenced by his personal celebration of the liturgy and the hugely successful World Youth Days, this involved a reappropriation of some Latin in the celebration of Mass, including Gregorian chant settings for the ordinary. Rubrics were more carefully observed, and abuses such as extemporaneous insertions or replacements of the official texts of the sacramentary or missal were sharply criticized. As younger clerics morphed into Benedictine priests and deacons, a desire to celebrate the extraordinary form, a wider use of Latin, and a preference for orientation, that is, the priest facing the east rather than facing the people, became more prominent. Church decoration and liturgical vesture followed the preferences and practices of Pope Benedict. Lace-trimmed albs and surplices and Roman fiddleback vestments began appearing in sacristies. What was for the young a bold step into the future appeared to older priests and bishops suspiciously like a return to the past. Statues reappeared, and most significantly, the tabernacle returned to the center of the sanctuary on the recommendation of the General Instruction on the Roman Missal. These changes could be interpreted as a repudiation of the liturgical reform of Vatican II. The old tension between culture and faith keeps appearing. Whether theological principles, current liturgical norms, or diocesan politics would become the deciding factor in resolving such difficulties has not always been clear. Fourth, as the average age of priests in the United States has risen, the contrast between the theological and liturgical formation of post-Vatican II decades and that of the late 20th and early 21st century priests has not been gradual, but rather dramatic. There is no middle group to buffer the transition from an older vision of priestly liturgical praxis and one that is more recent. The generation of those priests and religious brothers and sisters trained in the years immediately after the council has not been replaced, given the lack of vocations, which has prevailed for almost four decades now. This has consequences for the church at large, for the same personnel with the same education and training are reacting to new directions and trends without the ballast of younger priests and religious to mediate the transition. Finally, the unhappiness of some priests with the English translation of the third edition of the Roman Missal may well represent the residual resistance of older priests. The median age of the of priests in the United States in 2009 was 63, so it's higher than that now, who represent the largest demographic in the American church. These factors condition our ability to hear the clarion call for instruction and formation, which sounded forth from Vatican II. How are we to usher in the new era of the liturgical renewal? The agenda proposed in Numbers 15, 21, and 23 of the Constitution is probably our surest way forward. Theological instruction and formation in the liturgy has yet to become a priority in many seminaries. Quote, "These should have been the ends and means of a pastoral approach that today needs to be devised and implemented as soon as possible," close quote. We know from experience that cultural trends and pressures can poison academic debate or any serious attempt at pastoral evaluation. Clearly, the influence of Pope Francis vis-a-vis the ongoing liturgical reform of Vatican II is as yet unclear and untested. To date, he appears to prefer a simple, direct manner of officiating at the liturgy, sometimes without reference to current liturgical norms. If Benedict was accused of high church liturgy, Pope Francis seems more inclined to a low church approach. It is likely that it will become clear in time what the Holy Father's theological understanding of Christian worship and the sacraments. In the meanwhile, the church in the United States must move ahead. Given the need for a theological grounding, it would seem that the teaching of St. Thomas could be most helpful, particularly in his sacramental theology. Thomistic thought offers a context that, in the words of Liturgium Authenticam, quote, "safeguards also the faith and the unity of the whole Church of God," close quote. While a number of approaches to our present polarized situation have been explored, it seems that only in compliance with the mind of the Council itself are we likely to prepare a harvest of a fresh inbreaking of the Holy Spirit as evidenced in the renewal of our life of divine worship. We work and pray for this goal to be realized. Thank you.